Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the UN chief is appalled by the bloodshed at a school in Gaza. The U.S. Secretary of State continues his diplomatic mission on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. Physicians for Human Rights reports the highest number of medical personnel killed in Syria in a single month.
Nothing is slowing down with the attacks upon medical facilities and medical personnel.
And authorities search for answers to the Air Algérie crash. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The UN Secretary General said he is shocked and appalled by the carnage at a UN school in the northern Gaza Strip, where explosions killed and wounded many women and children. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
Ban Ki-moon was in Cairo Thursday and spoke of the attack after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Mr. Ban strongly condemned the shelling, which also killed UN staff members. He said the circumstances of the attack were still unclear.
I'm telling to the parties, both Israelis and Hamas, Palestinians, that it's morally wrong to kill your own people. Whole world is watching with great concern. You must stop fighting and enter into dialogue. Whatever grievances you may have, this is wrong. Why are you continuing to kill people? There are many other ways to resolve this issue without killing each other. I'm angry about what this is doing, what they are doing.
In New York, the Secretary General's deputy spokesman, Farhan Haq, said all the facts were not available in the immediate aftermath of the attack.
At this stage, we do not know, and I cannot verify who attacked the compound.
The UN chief has called repeatedly on both sides to avoid attacking UN premises. More than 110,000 Palestinians have sought shelter in UN schools and other facilities since the fighting began. Israel accuses Hamas militants of deliberately positioning their rocket launchers in Gaza's densely populated residential areas, raising the risk of civilian casualties when Israel fires back. In the last few days, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has found two separate weapons caches in facilities that it operates, one in a vacant school and the other in a school where the rockets subsequently disappeared before authorities could seize them. The UN condemned the incidents, saying they are unacceptable and that those responsible are turning the schools into potential military targets and endangering the lives of innocent persons seeking shelter there. In Washington, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said the United States is deeply saddened and concerned about the incident and the rising civilian death toll. She urged both parties to intensify efforts to protect civilians and the violence and reach a ceasefire agreement. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry continues his diplomatic effort to resolve the Gaza crisis. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with the American official and spoke with us from Cairo, Egypt, about a possible framework for a ceasefire.
The idea would be that this would be a two-step process. There would be, of course, the most immediate demand, which is a cessation of hostilities, a ceasefire for, say, perhaps 1 week, during which time there would be organized negotiations with the support and participation of the international community to address some of the broader underlying causes for this violence in Gaza, chiefly among them the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza and that economic impact on the area.
You mentioned the international community would be involved. Who would that be?
That's still being worked out. It is our understanding, at a minimum, the participants that negotiation would, of course, be the Israelis, the Egyptians, the United States, the European Union, perhaps the Qataris and the Turks as backers of Hamas.
Hamas wants to have the blockade stopped, but what about the Israelis? Would they be satisfied with just having the bombing stopping?
The most immediate way that that blockade is likely to be lifted is, or at least eased, is through the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. So that affects less directly the Israelis. However, the Israeli concern about the opening of the Rafah crossing is that Hamas would be able to use that crossing to bring in armaments. So that was the Israeli concern that during the time of the Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, when that border was open, that that's precisely what happened, and that some of the rockets that are now landing in Israel entered Gaza during that time. So there would have to be, it wouldn't be just an entirely open the border and anyone can bring in anything that they want. There's the possibility of some international presence, perhaps the European Union, you know, as you understand, all of these things are in flux, but perhaps there would be a role for the European Union in monitoring the traffic across that Rafah border.
There's also been a great deal of concern about all the tunnels they have found.
Yes, and it would appear that if this two-stage process were to go into place, that it would be a ceasefire that froze troops in their current position so that it would not necessarily be an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, but an understanding that Israeli troops would advance no farther into Gaza, which, again, if this works, would allow Israeli defense forces to continue to search and destroy these tunnels without, the hope would be, engaging directly with Hamas fighters or Palestinian civilians in Gaza. But again, that's all of this is simply part of how the international community is trying to stop this violence. And of course, no agreement is an agreement until it's agreed upon.
VOA correspondent Scott Stearns speaking with us from Cairo. Physicians for Human Rights has been tracking what they call deliberate attacks on medical personnel and facilities in Syria. We spoke with Aaron Gallagher, who leads the organization's interactive map, tracking the incidents.
Well, we're finding that, you know, nothing is slowing down with the attacks upon medical facilities and medical personnel. In fact, the very worst month for the deaths of medical personnel in Syria was in May. And the second worst month for attacks upon facilities was recently in June. So the numbers are still, they're not letting up. The numbers are still high. This seems to have become the norm in Syria.
Maybe you could share with us some of those numbers.
We've documented 175 attacks total on medical facilities in Syria. 12 that happened recently in June, and that's the second worst month. The highest month was in August and September of 2012. In May, we had fewer attacks on facilities, and that was with 4. In terms of medical personnel, we've been able to document 526 personnel that have been killed since the start of the war. In May, the highest month, there were 30 medical personnel killed, with about 20 of those we believe to be targeted killings, meaning they were working inside a hospital that was targeted, or they died of sniping, of shootings, of torture in prison. And recently in June, the numbers were 19 medical personnel that were killed.
Now, you say this is deliberate from the government in Syria.
The vast majority, 90% of the attacks on facilities are committed by the government, as well as even higher numbers, the vast majority, about 99% of the killings of medical personnel are also committed by the government.
To be the devil's advocate, how do you collect your information?
Very good question. We use a number of different sources. First thing, it always starts with open source research of both English sites and of Arabic sites. Everything that exists on the internet, so it can be anything from UN reports, NGO reports, local organizations, councils inside Syria, the Ministry of Health in Syria, Facebook, YouTube, other social media, everything that we can find on both sides. We're searching. Our goal is to put out there who's being attacked and what's being attacked. by both sides, but we're finding that it's predominantly the government. In addition, we do use field sources inside Syria. Many of them work or are associated with medical organizations to help us corroborate and report attacks happening inside. And then we use aerial imagery also to at times help investigate or verify if attacks have happened. The nature of the war and those that are on the outside, we do hear more from the opposition than from the government. So we realize, you know, it's not completely even-sided reporting, but still we are searching for everywhere we can, government sites, et cetera, that are reporting, and then we report what's happening.
And what do you plan to do with this information?
We've mapped it. We've created an interactive map that is on our website and that has gone out to organizations and to the media, and every attack that we've been able to corroborate, and that's a targeted attack, meaning a violation of international humanitarian law, we map it on our map. You can go to it, open it up, see videos, see photographs where we have it, see the sources that we've used to corroborate the attacks. And just get the word out there and visually see what's happening. There's always a report in our findings and methodology that accompanies the map, but visually we feel the impact is huge just to see how much is happening and where it's happening.
What is the website people can go to see this map?
It's the Physicians for Human Rights website, so phrusa.org. And you'll see the Syria map, and click. And when you click on it, it becomes live, and you can open up all the incidents, all the attacks, and get information there, as well as other live links that are on the map that show a time lapse of the attacks that have occurred over the years. See the numbers per month and per year, our findings, and the aerial imagery, and all the information is on the map.
Erin Gallagher, Director of Emergency Investigations and Response at Physicians for Human Rights.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The United States is accusing Russia of firing on Ukrainian military positions in troubled eastern Ukraine from inside Russia. Washington contends Moscow intends to supply pro-Russian rebels with bigger and more powerful weaponry to fight Kiev's forces. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf.
We have new evidence that the Russians intend to deliver heavier and more powerful multiple rocket launchers to the separatist forces in Ukraine, and have evidence that Russia is firing artillery from within Russia to attack Ukrainian military positions.
A spokesman for the U.S. Defense Department said Russian forces fired artillery shots into Ukraine on Thursday. He described the Russian assault as a clear escalation of weeks-long fighting in eastern Ukraine between separatist rebels and the Ukrainian military attempting to retake control of rebel-held cities. Authorities appear to have ruled out a missile attack in the crash of an Air Algérie flight that went down in Mali on Thursday, but many questions remain. The plane was carrying at least 116 people, and French President François Hollande says there are no survivors. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Les soldats français qui sont déjà sur place.
In a brief statement at the Élysée Palace in Paris on Friday, President François Hollande said French soldiers had reached the crash site of the Air Algérie plane in northern Mali and recovered one of the black boxes.
Ce que l'on sait déjà, c'est que les débris de l'avion sont concentrés sur un espace.
The French leader said the aircraft's wreckage was strewn over a fairly small area. While weather may have caused the crash, he said no hypothesis can be ruled out. France says 51 of its citizens were on board. The plane had been flying through bad weather, but experts say that is rarely the only reason for a crash. Earlier, France's transportation minister said experts have ruled out a missile strike like the one that downed the Malaysian airliner over eastern Ukraine. Experts say a bomb may also be unlikely because it seems the plane may have crashed on impact. Technical failure or pilot error are other options, but officials say the Swiftair company that owned the plane had a good reputation. The flight, which originated in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, crashed about 150 kilometers south of the Malian city of Gao. The remote and deserted area was the target of a French military offensive last year to oust Islamist militants controlling it. Antoine Glaser is a French journalist and Africa expert. In a radio interview, he said the area was less dangerous today than parts further north, but no part of the region is fully secure. In Africa and in France, relatives of the passengers are waiting for answers. Amadou Ouedraogo, a Burkinabe living in western France, had seven relatives aboard the Air Algérie flight. He told French media that he's waiting for news about the bodies and what comes next. It's very hard, he said. Swiftair says a total of 24 Burkina Faso nationals were on the plane, along with the French passengers, six Spanish crew members, and people from at least 13 other countries. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Survivors of a vessel smuggling migrants from Libya to Italy last week described tales of brutality and mass murder during their voyage. The International Organization for Migration reports the boat sailed from Libya with 750 migrants aboard and arrived in Italy with 569. It says as many as 180 people are believed to have perished. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The voyage, which began in Libya, ended Saturday with the Italian Navy rescuing hundreds of migrants from the overcrowded smuggler's boat. Survivors recount tales of horrifying brutality, racism, discrimination, and clashes among the different ethnic groups aboard the vessel. A spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Flavio Di Giacomo, has interviewed about 25 survivors in a reception center in Sicily. He says all are young men between the ages of 18 and 24 from sub-Saharan Africa. He says all are traumatized by their ordeal. The spokesman says the smugglers had assigned migrants from Syria, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Morocco places on the two upper decks where they could catch a sea breeze. The migrants from sub-Saharan Africa did not fare as well. He says the smugglers forced all of them to go into the hold of the boat.
It means that they were forced by smugglers with knives, and they were beaten by smugglers, and they were cut. I saw their cuts on their bodies. And to sit in the hold close to the engine, where actually the situation is very dangerous, is very painful because it's heat, there is no air, you can die, as happened actually, but they cannot have any other choice.
He says the Africans were beaten back when they tried to go to an upper deck to get fresh air. He says 29 migrants died from heat and asphyxiation after being forced to remain in the hold. He says witnesses told him that many of the migrants were kicked and stabbed, and about 60 were thrown overboard into the sea. He says the African migrants aboard the boat were from Nigeria, Niger, Mali, Ivory Coast, and Gambia. He says many were fleeing wars, religious persecution, and collapsing economies. He calculates the smugglers made about $670,000 from this one dangerous voyage.
The smugglers, they are characterized by also by a very racist behavior towards African migrants, those who arrive from sub-Saharan Africa, those who are, let's say, black. While the other nationalities have life jackets, they are not even provided with any life jacket, because actually probably their lives has less value for the smugglers.
Di Giacomo says five people accused of violence and murder have been arrested and are under investigation. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 800 people have died this year alone in the Mediterranean, many of them seeking safety from conflict and civil war. It estimates more than 75,000 refugees and migrants have arrived in Italy, Greece, Spain, and Malta by sea in the first half of 2014. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
In conjunction with the International AIDS Conference this week in Melbourne, Australia, VOA is presenting a special series of reports that take a global yet personal look at AIDS. Although HIV/AIDS is now a treatable condition, a positive diagnosis is still a life-altering experience. In today's report, we travel to Cambodia, where people living with HIV are often disowned by friends, family, and the community.
Each morning as Uk Navi stands in front of the mirror, she glances at photos of her late husband and remembers the good times they shared. He committed suicide after learning he was HIV positive. After her husband's death, Uk Navi continued to live in her home near the Thai border.
Shortly after I held the funeral for my husband, I was looked down on and treated differently by the villagers. Children in the village started making fun of my son, saying your father had AIDS. He might have infected the whole village.
When villagers set her house on fire, Uk Navi returned home to live with her sister near Phnom Penh. She was sick often, and a test revealed her worst fear. She was HIV positive.
My only sister and cousin showed disgusting behavior toward me before we ate together. But after I was known as HIV positive, they would not eat with me. Even when my child was playing around, they called him AIDS child.
Cambodia offers free medication for the country's 70,000 people living with HIV. But many must move from the countryside to cities for treatment. Those with little means live in squalor. Feeling desperate and alone, Uk Navi contemplated following her husband and committing suicide.
I felt so sick and skinny, and I no longer wanted to live. Then I thought of my son and took pity on him. So I strived to survive. Just for him.
Uk Navi is now feeling better, both mentally and physically. She receives housing, food, and medicine from Place of Rescue, a Canadian organization that supports people living with HIV. It is her son who brings her life purpose. But her thoughts often wander to her late husband.
I feel anger and regret every day. If only he was still alive, he would have received medicine and felt healthy like others with the disease. He shouldn't have been so short-sighted and decided to kill himself.
In 20 years, the International AIDS Conference has ballooned from a gathering of some 2,000 scientists at the inaugural 1985 meeting in Atlanta to this year's multidisciplinary gathering of 12,000 scientists, activists, and people living with the virus. The 2014 conference in Melbourne, Australia, covered an array of topics from hard science to social issues. Medical advances discussed at this year's conference included improvements in testing and treatment and a pill that may help prevent HIV transmission. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also listen again to this program or any of the International Editions. Go to our website, go to programs, scroll on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.